कफस उदास है यारों सबास है, कुछ तो कहो।
Welcome to the South Asian Studies at Stanford podcast, also known as the SAS Pod. I am Lalita Duperron, Associate Director in the Center for South Asia. All our podcasts and information about the center are available at southasia.stanford.edu. Before I ask today's speaker to introduce himself, I just want to remind all our audience members to please, please, please rate us wherever you listen to the podcast. Give us stars. A 5 is a really great number. And if you have a couple of minutes, just say a few nice things about us. Anything that comes to mind will really help us negotiate the algorithm that we live by, for better or for worse. Today's guest is Shantanu Nevrikar, who has just returned from his field work in India, and I am so glad he's making time for us today. Shantanu, welcome to the SAS Pod.
Hi, Lalita. Thank you so much for having me here, and it's truly an honor to have a chance to speak to you about my research.
Well, I so look forward to finding out what you've been working on. So why don't you start by introducing yourself? Start very basic, and then we'll start zooming in as we go on.
Absolutely, absolutely. My name is Shantanu Nevrikar. I am a fifth year PhD student at the Department of Anthropology at Stanford. And my broader research and academic interests revolve around studying the social and cultural processes underlying markets and the economy, and specifically also the anthropology of the economy, anthropology of the state and bureaucracy and caste. For my PhD, I'm studying cooperative banks and credit societies in the state of Maharashtra in India. And I'm studying how they have negotiated and shaped economic relations, caste and identity in the region. And I study them within a broader context of associations of various kinds that are formative to economic and social life in India, like caste associations, trade unions, merchant chambers, all of which work alongside these cooperatives. So my research examines how they have shaped these ideas of self and identity, how they participate in the broader economy and in shaping the social relations between different castes and communities. We can talk more about cooperatives later on, but this is basically what my research is around.
Can you say a little bit about what distinguishes an association from a cooperative? And also you use the terms caste and community. And I feel sometimes people use community so because they don't want to say caste.
Yeah.
And that's probably also how people think about caste sometimes, like in our community, we do this or that. But do you see those as distinct? So two separate questions, I guess, association versus cooperative and caste, not versus, but as different from community.
Right. So let me first sort of talk about cooperatives and associations. So when I say associations, I mean any kind of a collective mechanism of individuals coming together beyond their immediate families, or probably somewhere like in extended ties of family as well. They feature in as well, and they're dealing with certain collective issues and concerns. So an association becomes a way of gaining social visibility, advocacy, furthering social unification and reform in certain ways. And these are the concerns that usually bind an association together. Various political scientists and other theorists have talked about associations as being very central to democracy. Foundational texts on democracy, like Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, or even more recent works which talk about the way social capital builds builds democracy, like Robert Putnam and his co-authors. All of them are talking about associations as being very central to all of this. And so cooperatives, now let's talk about them. They are, in a way, these economic associations based on free and voluntary membership, collective ownership, and democratic governance. So they work on democratic principles, and all everyone who participates in these cooperatives are technically co-owners. So the equivalence of that in America would be a credit union, where you become a member and then you are a part of this whole structure. The cooperatives have historically been such institutions, and but at the same time in India, I think, while adhering to quote unquote formal democratic practices, and under a lot of state regulation, cooperatives have not been particularly inclusive in all senses of the word. In fact, as the case of urban and small town India shows, which is where most of my research is based, cooperatives have increased in number, but they have largely spread as almost as quasi family-led or community-led kind of initiatives and firms, which were usually certain either families or castes or certain politically influential individuals are kind of dominant in a way. And this is true for a lot of the state-supported and aligned cooperatives as well, but also certain which are not in a way as state-supported, which are more community-based in a way you can say. Throughout the past century, like the whole 20th century, cooperatives were very central to imaginations of alternatives to both capitalism and communism. You talked about as this middle path where you can avoid the extremes of both in a way. Across the third world and even in the West, cooperatives emerged broadly in relation to these visions of economic organization, centering around, worker-owned collectives and the same. But I'm largely tracing some a history of cooperatives in India that's and their current situation, of course, and anthropology as well, and tracing how they're part of this history and yet diverge in very significant ways from this so-called vision which they had in a way.
Okay, well, I have follow-up questions, but
Okay.
we won't stay with those. We will continue with the conversation, and then I'm sure those things will come up naturally. And do you want to say a little bit about caste and community, or do we
Yes,
will we
of
address that
course.
later
I'm
on?
sorry. I
And
lost my
you should never ask two questions at the same time. It's podcast
No,
101,
absolutely
real
not.
rookie mistake. I'm
That's
sorry.
completely fine. That's just the way conversations work. Caste and community. So the way I talk about caste and community are kind of central in my work because they're integrated in my work in larger ways because I am looking only at caste-based communities in a way. And wherever I look at communities which identify themselves as, say, around religion or around other markers, in my observation, they have behaved as castes more or less in these in my field side. And I'll tell you why. I think this description will probably bring the explanation really clearly. So in a way, all of what we identify with castes, which is that an endogamous community, sort of a self-enclosed kind of a boundary, and in a way being within one society and yet at the same time being compartmentalized as if they're different rooms in a building with all the where each room is sort of closed off from the other. That was the metaphor which Dr. Ambedkar used. And most communities that I was seeing, while they coexist in this town, they display, even if they're not caste Hindu communities as such, they display caste-like features, even if they say claim to be Jain or claim to be a community based on language or any other kind of a marker. And so caste in a way pervades the social dynamic of relationships between communities. And in a way, cooperatives and associations help me look at these because and looking at them together, looking at more than one cooperative or more than one association helped because not only could I see how things are working within these institutions, but also across them, how they were relating to each other, how they were relating to, making sense of relations between communities in this town. And so that's kind of why I would say caste and community are way more integrated than what people give than what people as like assign them, well, the meanings that people assign them on a usual basis.
Thank you. That was super helpful and very clear. So you talked a little bit just now about the kind of raison d'être, I guess, for cooperatives across the global south. Can you say a little bit more about associations and how did they emerge? What's kind of their historical trajectory and why would people be attracted to an association over a cooperative? Although you seem to say that associations are more successful in what they try and do.
So associations in my work, I am looking at associations broadly in their relationships to each other, but I'm specifically focusing on cooperatives. And cooperatives are also associations. They are economic associations of people sort of coming together towards seeking certain economic ends. And so in my work, I look at cooperative credit societies and banks, where if you're a member, only then can you take a loan from them. And the pool capital is basically from the shares that are subscribed by each member,
Got
and
it.
also the deposits that people make in these cooperatives. And so that is where my focus has been on. If you look at the history of cooperatives, say in India, they trace back to the very beginning of the term cooperatives themselves. Like when they emerged in Europe, they simultaneously came to India through certain British administrators who were living in a time of deep agrarian distress and indebtedness, which continues still today. But the kind of indebtedness and the kind of agrarian relations were significantly different at that point than they are now. These villages were largely debt was funneled through certain money lenders, and they were called saukars in rural Maharashtra. And saukars were largely, I would say, Marwadi and Gujarati baniya in terms of the communities. And so due to certain peasant-led insurrections that happened, certain sort of changes in the way the ideology of the way British looked at India, kind of the way it shaped it. Cooperatives became a way for the British to say that, hey, let's create this sort of a village community, this kind of an insular a group of so not insular, but like independent rather farmers who can operate and be agriculturalists on their own right, and you don't need these money lenders who are kind of outsiders who are put into this idealized kind of a village community. And in a way, this kind of a way of looking at the village as a sort of a community where the money lender was an outsider was a slightly outdated and an inaccurate way, because the money lenders were very much a part of village life in a way. But basically, what this kind of a sense of looking at the village did was it helped provide a rationale for cooperatives to come into the rural economic setup. And they became an instant hit. And a lot of villages and farmers ended up kind of using cooperatives in their to set up credit societies, to set up kind of, sort of farmer-owned kind of collectives. And they were largely also happening at a time in Maharashtra where the non-Brahmin movement was in place. There was this emergence of an independent peasantry, and this idea of a rayat, which is a collection of all peasants. So there were political movements which also created the space for cooperatives to replace rather the village economy that was centered around certain money lenders until then. And money lenders didn't vanish, but they for sure lost their monopoly over rural credit because of this. And so the next big push of cooperatives, so cooperatives become established in Maharashtra around this time, around credit societies. And the sort of next big push happens around the time of when Maharashtra gets statehood. So like, you know, this is around the 1960s. And that is when sugarcane has, which has largely always been a very popular cash crop in Maharashtra, and starting from the 30s, 1930s, it starts getting a lot of like the produce of sugarcane starts expanding a lot because of irrigation projects expanding, because of all of those things, and because sugarcane is a very massive, massively water intensive crop. So what ends up happening is that until then, until the 60s, most of the sugarcane producers are again urban industrialists, largely Gujarati, Baniya, largely Marwadi, and this group of dominant caste, mostly Maratha, kind of a kind of a agricultural elite, which are also connected to the Congress Party in a big way. And so, you know, I often use the sort of a three terms, like politicians, like agricultural elite, and agricultural landlords, and sugar barons. So these strive to become sort of sugarcane barons, and they start opening cooperative sugar factories. And so in the whole of pre-liberalization Indian kind of economy, sugar factories become very politically supported, and they also become a hub of this Congress-based kind of dominant caste and Maratha kind of political elite that rules the state of Maharashtra. And so cooperative sugar factories and credit societies, they start sort of the entire rural economic setup of especially of certain sugarcane belts of rural Maharashtra becomes directly tied to these cooperative institutions. And so what we have now is that while this liberalization-based policy, pre-liberalization policy of, you know, providing subsidies and permits to certain factories has gone away, what we continue to have is the presence of these cooperatives, they continue to be supported by the state. But at the same time, even though they are dependent on the state in many ways, they are still highly popular, and they do form a lot of the way, especially in rural India, the rural Maharashtra, the way people think of how power operates in their setup. At the same time, I am looking at a region which is not sugarcane intensive, so it's a slightly drier region. It's neighboring many sugarcane belt, sort of fertile regions of around it, but it's a slightly drier region. And it's slightly more urban. So like, you know, because I was in this small town, which is a small town by Indian standards, it has a population of 400,000, but it's also a district headquarter. It is a kind of a central urban space for the villages around. And so it's a very trade-based kind of a economy that operates there. And so even though like so the rural sites that I was in were way more dependent on this one town than what you see in other parts of you know, neighboring kind of rural belts, where where the effort is to create agriculture as the kind of and sugar factories become then very important in a way. But in this belt, there were other alternative sources of occupation. So even though it was dry, it wasn't really poor in that sense, because of this.
So a cooperative to me sounds like a kind of power to the people association and
Of course.
a way for it's not quite a union, but there are similarities, at least in my mind, in terms of who has the control and this kind of egalitarian membership and things like ideals like that. And yet you make a link with the Congress Party and it sounds from what you're saying that the government and politicians at broadly defined are invested in these cooperatives.
Yes, absolutely.
To me, that feels a little counterintuitive. That might be a me problem, but nevertheless,
No,
can you say a little
absolutely.
bit more about how the state and politics figure in these cooperatives?
So, great question, because what increasingly now, when the Congress is on a decline and it's the Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP, that has been on the rise, their effort has been to now center the cooperatives around their party machinery. And so a lot of these leaders whom I spoke about, who were kind of agriculturalist, agricultural landlords, who became sugar barons and are were Congress politicians, us have had in the last 20 years slowly started this process that started happening of them shifting slowly towards the BJP. And while the Congress and the other Congress kind of affiliated parties still control a lot of this, the BJP is entering this in a big way. And so when I said Congress, I meant because the Congress was the dominant party of that time. But now it's still very in the rural side of things is still very invested in politics and political parties and the power that they play. But there's another kind of parallel story of state regulation here that I want to talk about, because this makes it more linked to the urban side of things that I was talking about. So in a way, if you look at cooperatives, there are like two broad kinds of categories that come up. One is based on the jurisdiction of its activity, and the other is the sector of the lending. In terms of jurisdiction of its activity, there's like a village-based cooperative, a district-based cooperative, a state-based, and a multi-state cooperative. So Amul, for instance, the biggest cooperative in India, the cooperative milk producing kind of Amul, they are a multi-state cooperative, so they can operate across state boundaries. If you look at most villages in Maharashtra and across India, the most kind of dominant institution that you'll see around the cooperative is the village-based cooperative agricultural credit society. So in Maharashtra, it was called PACS, like Primary Agricultural Credit Society. And these are basically the only kinds of cooperatives that are allowed to lend to agriculture. So so this comes to the second kind of classification, that some cooperatives lend to agriculture, which are these, and then some lend to non-agricultural activities. And in the small town that I was looking mostly at non-agricultural cooperatives. So they depend on merchant capital, they depend on builders, they depend on more urban and small town forms of capitalism, and than in villages where it's where and also the thing is that the agricultural credit societies, these kinds of cooperatives are much more supported by the state through different mechanisms, through funding, through policy support than non-agricultural cooperatives are. And that's because of the historical investment that the Indian state has shown in agriculture. The thing is that in the rural areas, because of the close links to the state, the political class plays a much bigger role in the operation of these cooperative societies. In urban spaces, what has historically happened is that a lot of mercantile capital from rural areas ended up migrating to cities, small towns. And so the role of a rural political elite became it's not that they don't exist in the small towns, but they are way more in competition with merchants, with traders, with builders from various kinds of caste groups, and mostly the most and most the most dominant of whom are the kind of merchant so-called caste communities. So like Marwaris, Gujarati Baniyas, Punjabi Khatris, or Sindhis increasingly. And so the way that the small town economy of cooperatives is working is very invested in caste-based kind of capital and that is how people understand how power operates in this setup a lot. And I can talk more about this.
Okay, so now that you've raised this point, why don't you say a little bit more about how caste plays out?
Great question. Okay, I feel like often when I had gone to the field thinking about the way cooperatives work, I had just assumed that caste would play out in the same way and centrally across them, because living in a city, I had mainly only seen cooperatives and the cooperative banks and credit societies that had hit my eye were largely caste-based. But while a lot of these cooperative credit institutions, banks, and societies are caste-based, many other are not exclusively centered around particular castes, and they play out, caste plays out in all of these in some way, but rather differently. And so many of these are actually like occupationally centered. So they'll be around workers in a market would kind of have a cooperative, merchants at a market would have a cooperative, teachers in this particular district would have like their own cooperative bank. And yeah, membership to these would be kind of affiliated to unions or associations or membership within that particular occupational group. But there's kind of one connection that goes across these different kinds of cooperatives, and that's the centrality of social relations, of identity, and the form of recognition of the person and what they do as a sense of identity that's kind of central to across all of these cooperatives, whether they be caste-based or not. And so one word that I would often be told when I ask people that, you know, why have you borrowed from a cooperative rather than a non-cooperative bank? And they would say that it's because we have in Marathi what's called orakh there, or in a Hindi translation for that would be pehchan. Now, why this is different from using an English word like identity or recognition is that because it combines both these meanings into one, and that there's no real similar translation available in English for this. So if you want to, I'll just say in Hindi because I'm assuming a lot of the listeners would be more. It's much more of a shared language, but basically, if you want to say that I have someone I know at a particular cooperative, you would say मेरी उस बैंक में पहचान है. If you want to say that, so for instance, when I ask someone that, you know, why did this person who started this cooperative, why did they start? And then they said that this person had everything. They had land, they had a lot of these other things. He was this big man in the town, but yet he didn't have a pehchan. He didn't have a recognition of that sort. And so in a way, what I saw was that cooperatives are centrally located in the kind of social identities and hierarchies that make this town up. And so, which is why caste inadvertently becomes an important thing there, and that's across kind of cooperatives. So while many cooperatives are caste centered, right? Like they will be named after particular caste based communities, and there it's like broadly socially accepted across that, okay, like these are the people who would be you know, leading the director, the positions of the directors. These are the people who will be making up most of the members. And even if no cooperative is legally allowed to refuse members based on their identities, you know, you can refuse members based on the fact that you're not affiliated. So if it's a cooperative of workers, right? If you're not a worker in the market, then of course, like that is a fair ground of refusal for membership. But caste is not. But at the same time, these cooperatives end up largely being successful in managing their membership in a sense.
Right, but you say this, they even have the name of the caste. So if this is the
Yes.
cooperative of name of caste, and somebody from a
Yes.
different caste applies, then
Yes.
they're legally not allowed, or does that just not happen? Is this a completely theoretical situation? Nobody would apply because they know they're not going to get in anyway.
No, it's like they will, a lot of people apply and they do get it. They become members. It's
Okay.
just that so I'll tell you what, there are like various ways of managing these memberships, and in my opinion, it's the managing of membership that is kind of, as of now, I think that's my kind of understanding. That's the managing of membership that's kind of the most effective way of managing who the cooperative belongs to. So in a sense, like I'll just give you two kind of administrative criteria that are often followed. One is of a nominal membership. A nominal membership is basically a very transactional membership. If you want to borrow a loan from a place, from a bank or a credit society, you They don't give you a share subscription. They make you a nominal member. You're not a shareholder in the bank. Just for the purpose of this loan, you are a member. The moment you repay the loan, you and I have nothing in relation. So
Right.
it's like going to a normal bank. It's not like you're not anymore dealing with a cooperative bank,
Yeah.
where you're a member. And another thing that I saw was that depositors, so people who have deposits in the bank, don't automatically become members. They are not automatically given a share. It's when you want to take a loan is when you have to be when you have to even broach this idea of membership. And so a cooperative bank may have like 30,000 depositors, but they don't have 30,000 members. They have like 1 or 2,000 members.
Got it.
One of the cooperative banks, which was sort of big, it kind of dealt with merchants in the town, had this criteria that they had like it became very controversial in one of their general meetings. But basically what they had said is that we'll make you a member or a shareholder basically only if you borrow an amount above 10 lakh. So
Got it.
while they don't legally, they can't disallow you. You can't walk in and they're like, oh, you're not from this
Right.
place, we won't give you the membership. Or you're not from this group, we won't give you the membership. But there are these subtle ways in which they will disallow you. And what you said about the name of the caste being a thing, in this case, of course, it's like an automatic discouragement, right? Like if I'm not from,
Right.
if there's no like, so in, for instance, the only people who are not from that caste who will go to that cooperative are the people who live in the same neighborhood, say, or who have some contacts with people from that caste who are part members of that cooperative, and then they know that okay, we'll probably be able to get a loan here very easily. So the reason that cooperatives appeal to people is because you get loans more easily, right? Like that's the amount of paperwork, the amount of the criteria that you have to fulfill in order to get a loan from a scheduled public bank or a private sector bank is not, the bar is not so high in a cooperative. And so it works a lot on contacts. It works a lot on social relations. And that's where caste inadvertently comes in. I think one more thing I would want to say is that under most state government regulations in India, but particularly in Maharashtra, the board of directors in a cooperative are mandatorily subject to reservations. So they have out of say like a 13 body member, you'll have 2 seats reserved for women, 1 seat reserved for OBCs, which are other backward castes, other backward classes, 1 seat reserved for an SC or an ST candidate.
Yeah.
So 4 out of 13, for instance, are like reserved. And what I've seen is that often it's just assumed that the rest of the seats are going to be upper caste, in like especially in like bigger, more established banks, which were kind of started by the upper caste elite in a certain town. And then people from who are not upper caste are kind of relegated to these and considered not as meritorious, considered, that they are not the it'll be said that they are not experts enough, that they are not seasoned in the bankers and shopkeepers and the kind of financially knowledgeable people. And so those were the kinds of terms that were often used. These were the kind of hints that were given to me. And basically it was a kind of a looking down upon people who have become directors through reservations. And usually people who are leaders of these cooperative banks, the main chairman and everyone, they would only take people on the reserved seats amongst those who know that they are not going to ruffle the feathers. They are going to be sort of rubber stamps. And they otherwise those seats would often go empty. Like they actually go empty in a lot of cases, especially in like caste-based cooperatives, like caste
Sure.
aligned rather.
Yeah.
Those are like aligned to certain caste groups. So yeah, I mean broadly, I think I would say like this is how caste plays out. And I think like my fieldwork was kind of this kind of a it was this gradual kind of getting to know the distinct ways in which this was happening. And yeah, I can probably talk a little more about that.
Thank you so much. I feel that we could talk a whole, we could actually have a whole podcast on caste, but let us move on. I want to ask you about your fieldwork. I'd like to get into kind of like a day in the life of, Just like what exactly that looks like on, in the field, on the ground. But before I ask you that, I'm increasingly curious as I hear you speak. Why are you doing this? Like, it feels very money driven and very finance driven, and that's not how I think of you. All the conversations we've had over the years, I don't think, oh, here's someone who really loves a good capitalist situation. I could be wrong on
Being
that,
at
of course.
Stanford, yeah.
Compliment, by the way. So, what got you to this? And yeah, how does it, you know, because you're not an economist, you're an anthropologist. So can you just say a little bit more about your own personal motivation for this? And then you can move into, so you can make that as long or short as you want, and then just move into just describing a little bit of what you're actually doing in the field when you're out there.
Right. So I did my undergrad in economics, and I
There
was,
it is. See, we hadn't gotten to that bit. There it is. Okay.
I was thoroughly confused after that what I want to do with my life, and I think I didn't even know of something like anthropology existing, but I think my master's was in a interdisciplinary field. It was called development studies, and that's when I kind of shifted into an interest in qualitative or sociological or anthropological kind of methods. And so ultimately, when I got to Stanford, I wanted to work something around which was kind of based on the economy and something which focused on small town and rural economy, because that's not something which the larger discussions on India kind of focus on. And so that was something which I thought could be a thing to look at. And also, I was have always been very interested in caste, both in thinking politically and also thinking as an academic topic. And so to bring them together is where cooperatives became this interesting site. In conversation with my committee, cooperatives kind of became this interesting site for me to think of caste and the economy together. And so that's what I ultimately ended up, that's how I ultimately ended up coming to this. The conceptual interest was before I had an actual encounter with cooperatives in the field. And the fieldwork turned out to be so complex because of that, because I went with a very open mind and, you know, wanting to study just how cooperatives worked, and the extremely complex bureaucratic classifications in place, the way in which people related to different kinds of cooperatives differently, and almost took them as commonsensical, where I had to, as someone who wasn't used to those rural and small town way of doing things, had to really get into that logic of how people are using these different institutions and what is their significance. So I was in a town called Ahmednagar. It's a small rural town. It has a population of 400,000, which is like pretty small by Indian standards.
I was just going to say, you might want to qualify that.
Sorry. Yeah, sorry.
You might want to qualify what small means, but you just did
So by
quantify.
Indian standards, I wanted to give that qualification. And Ahmednagar has a very rich history of cooperatives. It was the district where the first sugar cooperative was built. It has been very central to a lot of agrarian and other kinds of movements as well. And so this being in this town, I was in a broader region where cooperatives were very dominant, rural cooperatives, but I was looking at the urban side of things. And so it was this very interesting, and because a lot of literature in Maharashtra in India has looked at rural cooperatives much more than the urban ones. And so for me, it was this kind of a different perspective that I wanted to also offer on the question. And just being there, I didn't expect the distinctions to be this vast and stakes, the distinctions held some stakes. But then seeing that these distinctions were vast and significant made me kind of happy about the choice that I made about my research as well. So this is, and I was working with five or six of these urban cooperatives and one rural credit society. And so I would often visit this village, which was close to Ahmednagar. But at the same time, in these, so some of these cooperatives were very centrally caste based. Some of them were around, one of them was around a workers, a trade union. One of them was associated with a merchant's chamber of sorts. So they were all catering to either certain communities or certain, occupational slash interest groups of sorts. And so for me, my interest was that what are the logic then of a cooperative credit society, of a bank? Like, what does debt do there? How do they think of membership, and whom do they lend to? And what basis are these decisions made? And how do they largely impact the way people think of themselves as a part of certain groups, certain communities, certain occupational kind of identities even, which and which occupation and caste have always been very closely tied in India. And at the same time, there are significant forces which take the two apart as well, largely being that people from different caste groups do want to say be merchant. So-called merchant caste groups are not the only ones who want to continue to be merchants. And so what do these people end up facing? What do they encounter when they look at this extremely closed sort of trading world of small town India? How do they end up mobilizing these resources? What do they do? And so yeah, caste, that's why it was a very significant question for me, both in terms of what I ended up seeing in the field, but also the kind of me in the field, in a way that the way I kind of ended up being identified, interpolated as a field, as an ethnographer in this site.
And how was that?
Largely, I think, so this is how a conversation would go. I would say that they would want to know where I'm from. I would say I'm from Pune. And Pune being an extremely Brahmin-dominated city, their immediate and my surname is an upper caste surname, but it's very caste ambiguous as to where it which exact caste it kind of aligns with. And so then they would ask me, oh, what's your proper village? What is like, even if you're from Pune, a city, where are your roots from? The way I spoke Marathi, the way I kind of sort of conducted myself looked very urban in that sense. And so and if everything else failed, they would ultimately guess that yes, this is someone who's Brahmin who's sitting in front of us.
And so, is
Which
this how people do
then,
it? They don't say what your caste, because I thought that was a perfectly acceptable question in many contexts.
I think it eventually came up. So if
Right.
everything else failed, they would directly ask me what my caste is. But of course, I think it's because increasingly I think a public caste in public life is very much active and very much still a very significant part. And at the same time, there's also this I think a lot of upper castes feel a sense of anxiety that, oh, I don't want to be called casteist, or I don't want to be seen as casteist. So in that sense, there are all of these strategies that I use. And not just by upper caste, I think from people across different caste groups. And so I was largely seen as this sort of urban kid from Pune. Kid, but kid for them, because I was speaking to people who were, mostly like men who were much elder to me. And so someone from a city like Mumbai or Pune, and they assumed that I, of course, did not know enough about how things worked here. But at the same time, I think after a while of continuously meeting some people, they would also be surprised as to how I now know so much about the way things operate here. So it was, it was also not just being a researcher in the field, but specifically an ethnographer and who was kind of looking at very detailed processes. And so people end up, so my experience was that when I would go to a place and tell that I'm a PhD student, I would be greeted. They would talk to me. And at the same time, if I continued visiting certain institutions, certain people, they would grow suspicious at a later point that why am I continuing to do this? And so the only logic that they could kind of think of is that this is probably a journalist who is in who's embedded in the field, or you know, they would interpret me as someone who is not just a PhD student, like, because which PhD student wants to know so much? Like, no, you just want to write your dissertation and be done with it. And so that so this is basically, I think, what my experience of being in the field and trying to kind of trying to do this field work, I think, was, and how I was interpreted that. Yeah.
Wow, that is so interesting. For me, obviously, my positionality is so different. But the
Of course.
suspicion, of course, I did my field work a long time ago, in the north, but the suspicion really rang a bell, like, because I was working on considered an insignificant genre of Hindustani music, and coded as semi-classical, and people were always like, "Oh, you can't write a PhD on that. What are you doing?" And then some people thought I was just out to steal their songs. That was
Right.
my
Yeah.
motivation, so they,
Absolutely.
which has a very long history in terms of an oral tradition and people coming in. Bhat Khande, the original writer down of Bandishas, if you will,
Yeah.
was treated with much suspicion, and I think in many ways with reason. So there is a kind of a tradition of suspicion, I guess. So it's
Yeah,
interesting that
absolutely.
even you, appears from within the community, also comes up against that because your methodology makes no sense.
Yes, absolutely. It's not something that they've seen before. And so
Make sense of it.
they try to relate it to a familiar subjectivity in their head, which was largely that of a journalist or even an auditor in my case. Like people based in these credit societies and banks would think that I have somehow like come to sort of get to know their finances in detail, and then I would tell them I know nothing of that, so like please don't worry. Even if I saw your balance sheets, I wouldn't be able to know the head or tail of what is happening, so please be rest assured none of that is coming in. So
If you were, say,
yeah.
pretend you were a PhD student in the Department of Anthropology at Stanford, if you were actually an auditor. So, there might be, if you're an auditor listening, here's a tip for you.
Yeah, you can say that you're an anthropologist.
It's so good talking to you. We need to wrap up, but you're writing now. Is that what's next in your trajectory
Yes,
towards
yes.
full
Yeah,
adulthood when you're no longer a kid?
it does feel, I think PhD gives you this, they're like, I think you're doing like three things one after the other. It's not like one PhD often. And so it does feel like the whole page has turned now from like coming back after field work, starting to write. And yeah, I will be writing, and let's hope something interesting comes out of it.
Sure, it
And
will.
it's a process. Let's hope
Well,
so.
good luck with the writing, and
Thank
I
you.
know
Thank
how
you.
stressful that is. And thank you so much to take from for, thank you so much for taking time out of your writing schedule to come and talk to me and to the listeners of the SASPOT.
Oh, thank you, Lalita, and thank you. And thank you everyone for listening, if you're still listening at this point. And it was truly an honor to talk to you. I think I'm gonna re-listen to this if I can and not cringe at myself. But if I
It's
can,
hard. I
just
listen to
to.
everything once through to see if we need to make any edits, and I cringe at myself all the time. So if you're out there
Thank
cringing, we are
you.
cringing with you.
And yeah, just to kind of know, I think sort of thinking about things over here as I was speaking, it helped me also come up with certain ideas for what I'm going to write. So it's a like that's the process that I think a PhD puts you through. So thank you.
I
Thank
love
you.
that. Well, thank you so much, and thanks as always to Soham Shiva for creating the music, and Manar Flekhanir for doing post-production. Thank you for listening to the SASPOD, the South Asian Studies at Stanford podcast. Find out all about the Stanford Center for South Asia at southasia.stanford.edu and find us on social media. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you for joining us, and I hope you can tune in again soon.
Makam faiz koi raah mein jacha hi nahi, makam faiz koi raah mein jacha. Thank you.